Well, the first thing I think he would do would be to stand up and tell the truth. I mean, he had a great expression that was just tell the truth and watch them scatter.
So the further away the problem is, the easier it is to postpone action on. And that's essentially what we're doing.
Be real. Because people in New Hampshire are really cool.
I'd say get in the game. This is a problem facing your generation. You have to have a voice in the decision. Welcome to Facing the Future, brought to you by the Concord Coalition on WKXL, New Hampshire's talk radio station. I'm your host, Bob Bixby. Each week, we take a nonpartisan dive into topics related to the federal budget, the economy, and how it all affects our nation's future. This week, our in-house Concord Coalition panel of experts, that is Policy Director Tory Gorman and Chief Economist Steve Robinson, and I will review a new report on fraud, government-wide fraud, by the Government Accountability Office, otherwise known as GAO. And then we'll talk about the Foreign Aid Supplemental Spending Bill passed by the House last weekend. And we'll also look at the 50th anniversary of the Congressional Budget Act. Finally, we will consider the latest news on the economy. So we have a lot to cover, a lot to get to. So, Tory, let's jump right in.
Grab your coffee mugs.
You wrote a new blog on this GAO report. And that's on our website. And, you know, normally we don't write a blog on a government report, but this one got a lot of attention. Just, you know, briefly, what was significant about this GAO report?
Sure. So GAO, as you said, the Government Accountability Office, is the basically the nation's, the federal government's auditors. They're the ones responsible for looking at the ledgers, the books, the accounting books for each agency, each program, to make sure that money is being spent correctly as intended and in the right amount. And we're very used to receiving reports from GAO when they look at specific programs. For example, if they look at the Earned Income Tax Credit program or the unemployment, the combined, you know, state and federal government unemployment insurance program, for example. So they're really good at diving into individual programs and determining whether or not that the program is spending money as it should. This was a new approach. In this case, GAO, it was his first ever attempt to measure what they're calling government-wide fraud. So not necessarily fraud within a specific program, but in general, you know, how vulnerable is the federal government to systemic fraud throughout, you know, all branches of government. And the results, they examined data over a five-year period between 2018 and 2022, inclusive, and they determined, based on the statistical method that they used, that the government, the federal government, experiences direct financial losses attributable to fraud anywhere between $233 billion to $520 billion per year. So that averages out to a fraud rate of approximately 3 to 7%, depending upon which year you're referencing. So, you know, it's unique in the way that they approach this problem. It wasn't, you know, looking at programs individually and then sort of adding up the fraud, totaling up the fraud that they see in individual programs. It was more about using a statistical method of estimation based on known fraud, estimated fraud, and undetected fraud, estimates of undetected fraud, to figure out, okay, how much, you know, government wide are we experiencing. So yeah, it was interesting. It obviously it generated a little bit of controversy with respect to the Office of Management and Budget. That's the executive branch agency that's responsible for, you know, distributing money to all of these agencies and conducting oversight. So it's basically GAO poking at OMB saying, hello, there's room for improvement here.
Yeah, I want to get into that pushback from the OMB, but you know, one of the things that concerns they had was a model, the modeling right. That was done here, which, as you said, was not based on like adding up a lot of known instances of fraud. It's referred to as a Monte Carlo model. Could you unpack that a little bit?
Oh my gosh.
I mean, Monte Carlo model doesn't sound off the top of my head like something GAO would be doing.
Well, think about Monte Carlo, you know, gambling, roll the dice, okay? Yeah. And see what pops up, right? So what a Monte Carlo simulation model basically takes inputs, values of inputs, and creates a probability estimate around the inputs. It basically assigns a range of values based on inputs. And then it tells the computer program to pick random values of each input to arrive at an output, so an estimate. And then it repeats that over and over and over and over again. So imagine, you know, rolling the dice for each input variable, coming up with an output, and then repeating that over and over and over again. And it develops sort of a probability estimate around the output variable. Where do most of your observations lie after conducting this experiment, the statistical experiment, thousands and thousands and thousands of times? So it generates what we call a confidence interval. It doesn't generate a point estimate per se. And you know, it doesn't say, hey, the government experiences X amount of fraud per year. It says, hey, we are 90% sure, in this case, 90% was their confidence interval. We are 90% sure that the federal government experiences fraud anywhere between, you know, $230 billion and $520 billion a year. So the fact that it was a statistical approach, you know, based on estimates rather than an actual physical count, you know, an accounting, a forensic accounting of fraud, I think is what generated a lot of the controversy, because it's an estimate. It's not an actual count.
Yeah. And the number is pretty big. And I think there's, you know, some concern. I have some concern anyway, that, you know, up on that upper end of 500 billion or so, it can lead to headlines like GAO says, you know, 500 billion a year in fraud. And that's not exactly what they're saying. But if people take that as the message, then you could have people saying, well, why do we need to worry about spending cuts and tax increases? All we have to do, or a lot of what we have to do, is just clean up all this fraud. I just want to read a line here from the OMB report, because usually agencies will comment on GAO reports and they aren't all that, you know, there'll be some pushback here and there. Like, we respectfully suggest that we you know, are doing a better job, but we understand what you're saying. OMB was pretty blunt in their pushback and it was about that, the fact that it wasn't based on specific, what they called actionable analysis. Mm-hmm. You know, they said OMB has significant concerns that this report will not further efforts to prevent and reduce fraud, but rather will create confusion and promote misleading generalizations that have no factual connections to specific fraud programs, which is we were just talking about. Rigorous analysis of fraud and fraud risk at the program level can be highly valuable in driving agency action and ongoing leadership prioritization of combating fraud. This report, though, does not provide that type of actionable analysis.
Right.
But those are like two various... I mean, I can understand the GAO approach. It's just a question of, you know, whether people take it for what it is or take it as some sort of, as OMB said, actionable analysis. Basically said, OMB said, you're not telling us what we could do to improve the mm-hmm. situation. You're just right. telling us that there's this possible fraud out there. Mm-hmm. Steve, in the 2 minutes that we have left on this, and we can go over into the next segment on this, but... any comments on the methodology or?
Yeah. We may want to continue this on the other side of the break here, but you know, it's just interesting that, you know, the Monte Carlo simulation is essentially saying that, you know, we have data to the extent that we know it. But if you apply that data government wide, I mean, you're sort of making this assumption that the things that we do know apply to the things that we don't know. And when you're talking about fraud, it's not clear. It's not clear what we don't know. I mean, you know, when the GAO does improper payment studies, they identify, you know, Medicare, Medicaid, unemployment, their earned income tax credit. You know, they actually do investigations, the IG programs for each agency. You know, they identify fraudulent transactions, individuals who are billing for services that they're not entitled to, people who are unemployed in one state apply for benefits in another state. You know, so they're working and collecting unemployment. You know, EITC, you claim credit for children that you don't have. I mean, there are identifiable fraudulent activities that result in improper payments. But when you try to take that data from the things that we do know and apply it through a statistical method to the rest of the government, you know, it in my mind, it raises some doubt as to whether you can really do that. I mean, you're simply saying that, you know, if the things that we know apply to the things we don't know, then this is the result. And yeah, that's true. But I think as OMB points out, that may not be a correct assumption. You may not be able to apply the data for the programs that we do know to the rest of the government and come up with a plausible, realistic number. And certainly it's questionable how actionable that number would be.
You're listening to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Bob Bixby. Tory Gorman, Steve Robinson, and I are talking about government waste. And we'll be right back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Bob Bixby. Tory Gorman, Steve Robinson, and I have been talking about a new report by the Government Accountability Office on government-wide waste. And Steve, you know, when we left off, you were making a point that I think you may want to continue here about the usefulness or limitations of such reports.
Well, yeah, I mean, I was sort of trying to make the distinction. I mean, GAO is known for making annual improper payment estimates, where they estimate how much the government spends in an improper way, meaning that the wrong amount was given to the wrong person. And, you know, those estimates are around $200 billion, but that includes both overpayments and underpayments. So sometimes they overpay people, sometimes they underpay people. Both of those are improper. They're not the right amount. So in the case of this recent report, they're dealing with fraud. Now, obviously, if you make a fraudulent payment, that's improper. but improper payments are not necessarily fraudulent. And let me give you a specific example. So, you know, you have a Social Security beneficiary who gets a monthly benefit, Social Security benefit, and the person dies. Well, there's a delay in the notification of the death information to SSA. So it may be that for a month or two, they continue issuing payments to a person who's dead. Well, obviously, it's an improper payment to give payments to dead people, but it's not fraud. And there's the family, there was no intention to deceive the government. However, you can have situations that involve fraud, that involve dead people. I mean, obviously, if you steal someone's identity, you find out somebody died, you steal their information, and then you apply for benefits using that person's identity, that would be a fraud. And so, you know, one of the problems in both identifying the scope of improper payments versus fraud is a quirk in federal law. There's something called the death master file. And essentially, the Social Security Administration collects data on everybody who dies. Some of the data they collect from family members or from funeral homes or from, you know, other sources, that data is made publicly available. It's also made available to the Treasury Department through what's called the Do Not Pay portal. And so the government, the Treasury Department allows government agencies, both federal, state, and local, to use this database to identify individuals who may not be eligible for payments. And obviously dead people are generally not eligible for payments. There's another part of the death master file, however, and that's data that SSA collects from the states. That data, for whatever reason by the statute, is not available through the Do Not Pay portal. And so you have a situation where government agencies are using a database that's not complete. It doesn't have all the death data. Now, Congress recently gave SSA 3 years to make all the data available, and they're going to run a sort of a trial program. So for the next 3 years after that, which is coming up, I think, this year, they're going to be able to use the full data file. Now, it may very well be that once the full data file is available, they'll be able to identify more fraudulent payments. But right now, that data source doesn't exist. So when GAO made their estimate of, you know, fraudulent payments, it's not clear what data they would have used, because the data that's available to SSA isn't available to the Do Not Pay portal. And so you have this sort of disconnect between, you know, identifying the scope of fraud with these various databases that up until this year weren't available to the government. So, you know, that's just an example of how, you know, you have this interaction between what's improper, what's fraudulent, and limitations of data available to the government to both detect and prevent that level of fraud.
I know that somebody's paying attention, because when my father died, I got a letter very quickly from SSA saying, send back that last check.
I mean,
they were very efficient on that.
Yeah, that's probably the state data. I mean, from the studies I've read, generally the states notify SSA within a week of death. So it's quite possible if you died early in the month, SSA is notified even before the next month's check goes out, and certainly if not shortly thereafter. So when it works well. But again, SSA has access to all the data, whereas the Treasury Department does not have access to all the data. And so that's a limitation.
Well, switching gears rather dramatically here, I want to talk about the foreign aid bill that has been percolating for quite some time in Congress this year. And the House of Representatives did pass it, and we can talk a little bit about the politics of that. But first, Tory, I know you've been looking at this. What does the foreign aid bill include?
So the foreign aid bill is actually four individual bills. So the House took up each bill on an individual basis, and then at the very end, stitched it all up into one single bill and sent it over to the Senate. The four bills that the House voted on was emergency aid, military and humanitarian aid for Ukraine, about $62 billion. There was a second package, aid package for Israel, about $26 billion. An Indo-Pacific aid package of about $8 billion, and that's money to help Taiwan combat China's influence. And then there's something that I call a rump car. It was a catch-all piece of legislation that dealt with addressing the fentanyl trade across the border with Mexico. It dealt with seizing and transferring Russian assets, selling them off to fund Ukraine. It also had dealt with TikTok, you know, the popular social media app owned by a Chinese company that is widely suspected of spying on Americans. And so there was that provision in the rump car basically tells the Chinese company that owns TikTok that you need to divest TikTok, sell it to a U.S. company, or we're going to ban its use in the United States. And then the bill also includes some additional sanctions on Iran and Hamas. The bill passed passed the House over the weekend. And the Senate is coming back from its recess. The Senate is supposed to be in recess this week, but they've brought the members back to vote on it this week. So the question is whether the Senate's going to be in town to pass it in a single day, or are they going to be able to address this in a single day, or will there be some obstreperous members who want votes on some troublesome amendments that may draw the consideration of this legislation out a few days. But it's expected to pass the Senate this week and be sent to the president for signature.
Yeah, you know, one thing that I was struck by on this bill is the overwhelming bipartisan support each of those four provisions received that you went through. Because, you know, you would think that with all the delays and seemingly dysfunction over these things, they all of them passed with over 300 votes,
right?
and had significant bipartisan support. And I'm just wondering, you know, do we actually have a governing majority if just kind of left to their own devices without leadership? I don't know. I mean, it's just, you know, it strikes me how many votes these packages get. Why didn't, if it had that overwhelming support, why didn't it pass 6 months ago?
Good question. I think there is a functioning bipartisan majority in the House. I don't think there is a single party majority in either House. I mean, I think that if Democrats had control of the House, I think the bill granting emergency aid to Israel would have been very challenging. So I think the reason why the bill passed now rather than 6 months ago, the House went through the speaker drama last year where they booted one speaker and spent almost a month and a half trying to install a second speaker. And Speaker Johnson, sometimes you just need to let pressure build before actionable events can take place. And I think a number of things happened, including, October 7th in Israel, the attack, Hamas's attack on Israel. I think that was an action enforcing event. But I also think, Russia's progress in Ukraine, they've managed to take back a significant amount of territory. There have been lots of reports about how Ukraine is basically running out of ammunition. And so I think you combine those actionable events, those action forcing events together, and eventually the pressure just becomes too great. And Speaker Johnson realized he needed to put legislation on the floor. I think the way he did it was smart, by dividing up, each issue into its own separate piece of legislation, putting it on the floor, and then stitching it up into one single bill at the end and sending it over to the Senate. It's not a unique approach to legislation, but I think it was a smart way to get the bill across the line.
Yeah, and it's not the first time. Not that he used the same procedure, but, we had going back to Speaker McCarthy, we had the deal with Biden on the debt ceiling to avoid a debt default. And then we had a bill to avoid the government shutdown on appropriations. So there have been these major pieces of legislation have found their way to final passage with overwhelming bipartisan support. But it sure looks from the outside like a torturous process.
Well, I think one of the things Johnson realized that he had to do, though, is that he has a very narrow majority in the House. I mean, right now it's only one seat majority. And I think he finally came to the realization that he would have to deal with Democrats in order to get legislation across the line, because his ultra conservative wing wasn't going to let anything get passed. So that was the
okay. Well, we'll consider more about how this reflects on the overall status of the congressional budget process, which is now turned 50 years old, on the other side of this break. Stay with us. You're listening to Facing the Future. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Bob Bixby. Tory Gorman, Steve Robinson, and I are talking about, we've been talking about fraud, and we've been talking about the foreign aid bill. And now what we're going to do is look forward a little bit on what comes next on this year's appropriations. Now that they've gotten the supplemental out of the way and they passed finally 6 months late, the 2024 fiscal year appropriations, we need to look now at the 2025 fiscal year appropriations. And as they do so, they're going to be using the Congressional Budget Act, which was written back in 1974, or at least enacted. And so it's celebrating its 50th anniversary this year. And a lot of people have been talking about, do we need a major overhaul, because some of the things that are provided for in the Congressional Budget Act don't seem to work anymore the way that they used to. Things like passing a budget resolution, for example, and then using that budget resolution to guide the annual appropriation bills. And then you have a conference committee and you pass you decide what the numbers are going to be for appropriations, and one house does their bills and the other house does their bills, and they have conference committees and all of this. And eventually they pass and the president signs it. So increasingly that process as laid out in the Budget Act hasn't worked, or at least they haven't followed it. And it certainly wasn't followed last year. So as we go into this year's budget process, it doesn't seem like so-called regular order is on the docket here. So going back to you, Tory, and I know both Tory and Steve, you both worked on the budget committees on the Hill. Well, let's just first talk about this year's budget process and, you know, challenges, and then we can talk about the bigger picture of things that might be done to improve the budget process. Tory, what do you think of the highlights or the challenges for this year?
Well, first, let me say that the fact that there's no budget resolution during an election year is not a surprise, a presidential election year. That's been common for a long time. It's not surprising to me that there isn't any thought of doing a congressional budget resolution this year because we've got a presidential election in November. But bear in mind, we already have some key numbers in place. All right. One of the purposes of the congressional budget resolution is to establish top line aggregates for the discretionary spending process where, you know, we pass 12, 13 appropriation bills every year and fund the federal government. The Fiscal Responsibility Act that we passed in 2023, which resolved the whole debt limit issue, established caps for defense and non-defense discretionary spending for fiscal year 2025. So presumably, the appropriations committees could get started, you know, drafting their legislation with those top line numbers in mind. So that could happen.
Let me just stop you there.
We're waiting to see.
It didn't happen in 2025. That was
because
2024. They had caps. So I'm just wondering. I mean, is it that do you think that they're sort of sick of the fighting, or will just kind of stick to the caps?
I think there are lessons learned from the 2024 appropriations process that will inform the 2025 process. I think, you know, one of the neat, I don't want to say neat, I'm using that in a very facetious manner, neat little tricks that House Republicans tried, you know, they tried to treat the caps in 2024 as an upper limit, not as a floor. So they tried to spend way below those caps, which technically could be construed as correct, but definitely violated the spirit of the deal that they negotiated with Democrats and President Biden. I don't see a repeat of that happening this year. One thing that's not in place for this year that was in place last year was sort of a side deal. There was an agreement, not on paper, but not in legislation, between Republicans and Democrats about sort of budget gimmicks that they could use to help goose up, if you will, spending, especially in the non-defense side of things, to avoid really big cuts. So that sort of side agreement happens every year. It could be big, it could be small. We don't have that agreement in place on paper for 2025. So while we've got the top line numbers in place, there is no side agreement on all these, you know, budget shenanigans that happen below the surface. And I think that could potentially waylay, aside from presidential politics, could also waylay the appropriations process this year.
You know, it's funny. There was an event by an organization that we work with a lot called the Bipartisan Policy Center. You frequently hear their people on this show, and they recognized the 50th anniversary of the Congressional Budget Act at a forum last week. And one of the speakers was Leon Panetta, who was a former budget chair of the House Budget Committee. He also served as a budget chair, director of the Office of Management and Budget under President Clinton. So he knows a lot about this. And he basically said the 50 years could be divided into two phases, where you had the first 25 years, the process worked pretty well. And then the second 25 years, it hasn't. And I think, you know, just going back and looking at that, that's about right. That's what it seems to me. The budget process did seem to work in the earlier years. People just assumed that we would pass a budget resolution and they'd work out the appropriation bills. And if you wanted tax or entitlement reform, you'd do a reconciliation bill. Mm-hmm. But for the last 25 years, it's increasingly broken down. And they only use reconciliation for, you know, cutting taxes or raising spending. And they end up doing bills that are negotiated, appropriations bills that end up being negotiated by leadership. Steve, any observations on what's likely to happen this year?
I'm not sure I have anything to add to what Tory said. I mean, you know, when members cut a deal, you think that that's the deal they're going to stick with. And as we discovered last year, you know, they did all that, they did their very best not to stick to the deal until, you know, until it became obvious they had to do something. You know, I'm hoping it will go more smoothly this year, but I guess that remains to be seen.
I wanted to go back to the point where you were remarking what Leon Panetta said about the Congressional Budget Act, how it worked for the first 25 years, but then didn't work for the second 25 years. And I think one of the things that's important to point out is during those first 25 years, you had members of the House and Senate that were involved in writing the Congressional Budget Act. And so they had a vested interest in, you know, adhering to the laws that they set out. I think where you see the budget process slip away is when, you know, bipartisanship became a dirty word, right? It was no longer a good thing. It was not a hallmark of a good lawmaker to work across the aisle and make compromises to get legislation passed. And so as politics became more partisan, you know, the budget process in and of itself is really onerous and time consuming. And as tribal politics infiltrated the budget process became more and more political and frankly, more and more stupid. And it just became a waste of time. And members discovered that there are ways to get around the budget process, things like deemers, okay, deeming legislation, which accomplishes sort of the bare minimum that a budget resolution has to accomplish. So I think we need to revisit the Congressional Budget Act because of the way partisan politics has infiltrated the process and just made it impossible. We need a new budget act that takes into account today's political environment.
You know, we've only got about a minute left on this segment, but you mentioned deeming. I remember the first time I heard that term, and it probably was about 25 years ago. It was sometime in that, around 2000, that they were working on something. And I heard that, well, if you don't do a budget resolution, they can do a deemer. They can just deem it. And I thought, what a wonderful device. If you don't do something, you could just deem that it's done. And I wish we could all do that. You know, I think I'll deem that I paid my electric bill this month. And
I have to say, first of all, there has to be legislation that gives the lawmakers the authority to deem. So it's a two-step process. Congress has to say, yeah, we think we're not going to get the budget process done this year. So we need to pass legislation that gives the budget committee chairman in both chambers the authority to, you know, deem top line spending levels. And then, of course, they go ahead and do it. So it's a two-step process, and it's not one that just happens in thin air.
Well, I do agree that there are things that need to be reconsidered with the Budget Act. But your point about the original drafters, the founders of the Budget Act, you know, eventually leaving Congress, that's I really think a key point, because they were the ones that had the vested interest. The other thing that changed is, you know, big budget deficits turned into surpluses. And,
Very brief period of time.
Well, for 4 years. But I mean, that's you were dealing with, a less constrained environment where it seemed like maybe a budget resolution and the constraints of the budget process weren't needed. And then, when we quickly went back into big deficits, I think the habits had been broken, and it was very difficult to try to impose that sort of discipline again. You're listening to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Bob Bixby. Tory Gorman, Steve Robinson, and I are talking about the history and future of the Congressional Budget Act, which is a lot more exciting than you might think. And now we're going to turn our attention to the economy, and that's really exciting. So stay tuned. We'll be right back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Bob Bixby. Tory Gorman, Steve Robinson, and I are talking about the Congressional Budget Act and, whether it needs some updating or reforms and why people say it's broken. Steve, you had a few thoughts about why isn't the Budget Act followed anymore?
Well, because people don't like to do things that they don't want to do. when I started on Capitol Hill back in 1985, there was something called Graham Rudman, was named after two senators, Graham and Rudman. But the goal back then was to balance the budget. And, you know, the budget process was focused on, you know, a 3-year or 5-year time period. And we were going to try to balance the budget. That was sort of the goal that everybody shared, Democrat and Republican. Deficits were bad. We wanted to balance the budget. And as time went on, it got a little bit harder to balance the budget. And so they decided that instead of doing 3-year and 5-year budgets, they'd start doing 10-year budgets, because that was the plausible period in which you could get to balance over 10 years. And, you know, in the late 1990s, 99, 2000, 2001, we actually got there. We actually balanced the budget. But then things after the dot-com burst in 2001 and the economy went south, the big Bush tax cuts. And, you know, suddenly the goal of balancing the budget sort of faded further and further into the past. And as we've moved forward in time, you know, we're looking at multi-trillion dollar deficits year after year after year. So essentially, what appeared to be an easy goal of balancing the budget in a reasonable, moderate amount of time, that has slipped from our grasp, and we're now faced with, you know, rising deficits as far as the eye can see. And, you know, because the parties can't agree on raising taxes and cutting spending, it's like, what fun is it to do a balanced budget? Because, I mean, or what fun is it to do a budget? Because we can't get it to balance. We can't agree on what policies would get us even to a reduction in the deficit. And so, you know, it's like, it's just no fun anymore. And so Congress has discovered that you don't have to have a budget. You can govern, you can pass the appropriation bills and leave the entitlement programs on autopilot. And we're just going to muddle through. And that's sort of where we are. And that's what's happened.
Yeah, that's it's the dieting analogies. You're so far off where you want to be. Oh, the heck with it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, that in a strange way leads me to the economy, because whatever, you know, Congress can't ignore the economy. Well, I mean, they can ignore it, but I mean, the effects that we have, the federal budget is going to have an effect on the economy, whether Congress does anything or not. So one of the big issues that we've been following this year is whether or not the Fed is going to find some way to have a soft landing from the high inflation, meaning can inflation be brought under control without causing a recession or a major increase in unemployment. And there was a lot of good progress on that during the year. And things have seemed to stall out right now on that soft landing. The plane is circling the runway, and we're not really sure. So that's led to, you know, people saying, well, the Fed's not going to continue cutting rates right now, because the inflation has come down a lot, but there's some question about whether there'll be further progress. So, Steve, I'll come back to you on a totally different subject here. You know, are we looking at rate cuts later this year, or might the Fed actually have to think about increasing rates again in order to tackle that last bit of inflation?
Well, I mean, certainly the pundits who talk about this issue have done a 180. I mean, you know, at the beginning of the year, everybody was convinced that the Fed was going to be cutting rates by March or April, or certainly by June, and we'd probably have 3 rate cuts, and then it was in the bag, and that was where we were going. And, you know, as we've seen for the first part of this year, the progress on bringing inflation down has basically stalled out. I mean, you know, go back to June, July of 2022, inflation peaked at almost 9%, you know, measured by the Consumer Price Index. And by summer of 2023, we'd brought the 9% inflation down to 3%. And everybody went, wow, we're making great progress. Inflation's come down. But basically, since June of last summer, it's been stuck at 3%, 3.5%. It'd go to 3.4, 3.3. I mean, we've seen through December, January, February, March. We don't yet have April numbers, but, you know, the assumption, or not the assumption, but the, you know, the data suggests that we're kind of flatlined. Inflation is in that range, and it doesn't appear to be moving. And so, you know, Chairman Powell has certainly signaled that he has no intention of cutting interest rates again until inflation makes further progress toward their 2% goal. And if we don't see that progress, I don't think it's out of the realm of possibility that the Fed may have to entertain another rate hike. I'm sure I'm in the minority view here on that point. And I think the consensus would be, well, maybe we'll just hold it steady and keep it at the 5.25 to 5.5 range that they're at now. And that's probably more likely. But if inflation starts ticking up again, I don't think the Fed has a choice. They're going to have to raise rates. Mm-hmm. And then that, of course, raises the prospect of unemployment going up, and the chances of the proverbial soft landing obviously is diminished dramatically.
Tori, what do you think?
Well, I feel like the economy is stuck in a chicken and an egg problem right now. Steve's pointed out multiple times on this show that housing and housing costs and housing equivalent costs, are a big part of inflation. And with so many people locking in 2.5% mortgages, years ago, people have got mortgage locks, so they're not moving, which means the supply of housing is low, which means housing costs are high. And as long as housing costs are high, inflation is going to stay high. So, and as long as inflation is high, interest rates are high, which means nobody's moving. So it just sort of creates this vicious cycle. And Steve thinks he's alone in this. Maybe the Fed might have to raise interest rates, but I'm right there with him. I'm first and foremost, I don't think there'll be any rate cuts this year. And it would not surprise me at all. I mean, we've got key economic data coming out this week. Or is it this week or next week? I think it's this week. We've got real GDP data coming out. We've got inflation, another measure of inflation, the Fed's preferred measure, the personal
expenditure index.
Try and say that three times fast. That's coming out this week, so it'll give us a picture, a direction arrow of where the Fed might be going at their next meeting. But yeah, I see this conundrum right here, and I'm not quite sure how the Fed solves it.
One thing we watch closely is interest on the debt, because the way that all those things translate directly into the federal budget is what the government has to spend on interest costs. And the 10-year number is pretty high, relative to where it was. Also, short-term notes, as you keep pointing out to me, are crucial in this regard, because so much of the debt is financed short-term, Steve.
Yeah, I mean, we saw interest, the 10-year yield was up, went up to 5% back in October. And, as the markets were convinced that the Fed had everything under control, you saw those rates creep back down. They were close to 4.2%. And then in the last couple of weeks, we've seen them creeping back up. So from the federal government's perspective, that's bad news, because, both short-term and long-term rates are in the 4 to 5% range. And that means every time we roll over the bills and notes and bonds that are outstanding, all, held by the public, all 25 trillion of it, 1% increase is $250 billion and a 1% percentage point interest rate increase. So yeah, I mean, we're going to see quickly the cost of interest on the federal debt rising to be literally the largest expenditure in the federal budget.
I think what may be different this time, as opposed to October when it went up to 5% on the 10 years, then they were thinking that the Fed had inflation under control. As you said, it began to come down. The interest rates began to come down because they thought the Fed was going to start lowering interest rates. And then when it became apparent that that probably wasn't going to happen because inflation stayed surprisingly stubbornly high, those interest rates began to climb back up again. And I suspect, for reasons that you both talked about before, that 4.6 or whatever on the 10 year is probably going to stay there for a while. My guess, but it doesn't seem like we're going to get a break, like the federal government's going to get a break on interest rates anytime soon. On that depressing note, we're going to have to leave it there for this week. You've been listening to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Bob Bixby, Tory Gorman, Steve Robinson, and I have been talking about the Congressional Budget Act, the foreign aid bill, government-wide waste, and the latest numbers on the economy. Tune in again next week. I'll be back with another edition of Facing the Future.